look up, and look ahead. Today on the Bible Study Hour, we're examining the first half of Psalm 37, where David is comparing the way of wickedness and the way of righteousness. We're reminded to fix our eyes on God and to take the long view. The Lord has promised to sustain the righteous and deal with the wicked in His time. Welcome to the Bible Study Hour, a radio and internet broadcast with Dr. James Boyce, preparing you to think and act biblically. It can be hard to wait on God when we see evil all around and the wicked seem to go unpunished. But if we look up to God and look ahead to the fulfillment of His promises, we can be sure that God won't forget. Grab your Bible now and turn to Psalm 37, verses 1 through 20.
One of the principles that guides the study of the Bible, I'm sure you've heard of it, is progressive revelation. What that means is that doctrine will be introduced in an early portion of the Bible, but not fully explained. We get the explanation increasingly as we move along. So later portions of the Bible throw light on what comes earlier. One example of that would be the doctrine of the afterlife. I find in the Old Testament that there are places in which the Old Testament saints anticipated a life with God after death, but you have to admit that's not a strong theme and it's not fully developed. It's not until after the death and resurrection of Christ that those things are unfolded more completely. Or you can take the matter of the atonement itself. The atonement is taught in the Old Testament and taught from the earliest times, but not as completely as later. And therefore, we're right to say that the Old Testament saints look forward to a deliverer, but they probably didn't understand the full ramifications of what Jesus Christ was to do. It required the revelation of that in history and the interpretation of that by the apostles as the Holy Spirit spoke through them for us to understand it fully. That's what progressive revelation means. Now, that's not surprising. The surprising thing is that sometimes it happens the other way around. What I mean by that is sometimes a New Testament text is explained in the Old Testament. So you find an Old Testament exposition of what is not fully exposited in the New. Now, an example of that is this psalm. You notice the 11th verse of the psalm, you have a reference to the meek. The meek will inherit the land or the earth. Now, that's one of the Beatitudes. As a matter of fact, that's where Jesus Christ got it. If you look in the 5th chapter of Matthew, in the 5th verse, you'll find there that Jesus talks in the midst of the Beatitudes about this very thing. The meek will inherit the earth, is what he says. But he doesn't explain it there. As a matter of fact, you don't find much explanation of what it means to be meek specifically anywhere in the New Testament, but that's what this psalm does. So here's a case in which the Old Testament really unfolds something that we find in the New. Now, it's an interesting psalm. It's an acrostic. Again, we've seen a number of those. Psalms 9 and 10 together made up an acrostic. That is a psalm in which successive verses begin with successive letters of the Hebrew alphabet. That was probably done as an aid to helping people memorize it. You could always remember what verse came second because it began with the letter B, and the verse that came third began with the letter C, and so on. We've seen Psalm 25, Psalm 34, those were acrostics. This is the fourth in the series. And then you've got Psalm 111, 112, 119, and very near the end, Psalm 145 is another acrostic poem. This psalm is very well known. As we read through it, I'm sure the verses ring true in your mind. Some of you will have memorized these verses. Delight yourself in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart. Many Christians memorize that, find it encouraging. Commit your way to the Lord, trust in Him, and He will do it. That's another one. Or better the little the righteous have than the wealth of many wicked. Or I suppose this one, we're going to come to it next week. I was young and now I am old, yet I have never seen the righteous forsaken or their children begging bread. Those are well-known and popular verses, and there may be others that you find particularly helpful. It's a little hard to outline this psalm. It's always hard to outline the acrostic psalms because the structure is determined by the alphabet. So they seem at times to be mostly a string of proverbial kind of sayings, the way many chapters of the book of Proverbs seem to be put together. And it may be forcing an outline upon it to try and treat it in any other way. And yet, as I look at it, it seems to me that there's certain emphases that emerge at different portions of the psalm, and it does suggest an outline that would go like this. If you make notes, let me suggest this as a possibility. First 11 verses really belong together. I think there's not much question about that. They describe the quiet spirit of quiet trust in God, and they end with the beatitude, the meek that shall inherit the earth. They are the best exposition of what that phrase, the meek shall inherit the earth, really means. Then you have a second section which describes the way of the wicked. That's what I would call it, verses 12 through 20. A third section, the ways of the righteous and the ways of the wicked contrasted. You find that in a lot of the Psalms, verses 21 to 26. You find an old man's counsel to the young, following that verse I read a moment ago, verses 27 through 33. And then finally, an emphasis upon taking the long view, verses 34 to 40. The only problem with that outline is that you find many of the things that I've identified as being an emphasis of one particular section in other sections too. So if you don't find it helpful, discard the outline and make your own, but it is a guide, I think, to help us through it. What we're going to do is look at the first two sections of that five-part outline in this study, verses 1 through 20, and then we're going to look at the last three sections, verses 21 through 40, in our second study. Now, the theme of the first part is set right at the beginning. It's a strong note, and it's emphasized, and is this: do not fret because of evil men, or be envious of those who do wrong. That verse, interestingly enough, is repeated in Proverbs 24, verse 19, and it has echoes in other places, and it's emphasized here. That phrase, do not fret, with which the psalm begins, occurs again in verse 7, do not fret when men succeed in their ways, and again in verse 8, do not fret, it leads only to evil. So obviously that's what these first verses are about. The Hebrew behind that is interesting. It really means don't get heated. And the reason I mention that is because we think along those lines ourselves and have expressions like that. We would say, don't get all hot and bothered over it. You see, that would be a colloquial expression. It comes pretty close to the Hebrew. Or don't get all worked up. Or if we put it on the other side, positively rather than negatively, we'd say, be cool. Now, I think when you translate into very colloquial language, that you always lose something. I don't think what David is saying here is exactly be cool. Be cool, the way we use it, means don't get excited about anything, it doesn't matter. David's not saying that. David's very concerned. That's one reason why he's writing the psalm, and it does matter. It matters to the Lord. That's one thing he's going to say to us. But he is saying something that we can identify with. We get so worked up in bad ways over things that it's unproductive. And what he's saying here is that we have to learn to trust God, to lay the concerns before him, knowing that he's more concerned about the injustices of the world than we can possibly be. Because, of course, that's what he's going to talk about. Later on in the psalm, he's going to talk about the wicked and the ways of the wicked and the fact that the wicked take advantage of the righteous. And he's going to say, that's what you have to leave with God. Now, I think it's worth asking the question, how do you do that? It's one thing to say, just calm down and leave it to the Lord. But how do you do that if you have any conscience or concern at all? You say, if you don't care, well, that's fine. You don't care about anything, but that isn't what it's talking about. If you do care, when the evil people take advantage of the innocent, you should care. How, when you get worked up in something like that, do you really leave it with the Lord? A little later on here, it's going to say the meek will inherit the land, but when we look at it, it seems like it's the wicked that inherit. At least they get their fair share or more, and they take what they get from other people. We say nice guys finish last. How can you not get worked up, heated, when you see that all about you? And you do. We see it. That's what our culture's like. You only have to look out the window and it's going on. Well, that's what David's talking about, and he gives us an answer. He says there are a number of things we have to do, and let me put it in two categories. First, he says we have to look up, and secondly, he says we have to look ahead. Now, when I say he says look up, what he means is we have to get our minds off the wicked and onto God. And even more, we have to get our minds off ourselves and onto God. That doesn't mean we won't be concerned, because God is concerned, but it is going to change the whole perspective. Because now we're going to see what happens not as being irrational and uncorrectable violence, but we're going to see that God himself is going to order it in his time for his own good, and he certainly is going to judge the wicked. So he says, get your eyes off the things and up to God and begin to take your perspective from there. Now there's a number of things he tells us to do, and these things are probably the best known verses of the psalm. He says in verse 3, trust in the Lord and do good. He says in verse 4, delight yourself in the Lord. He says in verse 5, commit your way to the Lord. He says in verse 7, be still before the Lord. And finally, in verse 8, he says, refrain from anger. Now let's think about each of those. They all tell us how we're to look up. Trust in the Lord. What that means is faith. That's the proper starting point. Trust is faith. It means that we're to have faith in God and trust him. But notice, faith is always coupled with good works. That's what's the unique thing about the biblical perspective. You see, nobody would ever have thought this up if this were a human religion. We would either say, trust God and don't worry, don't do anything, or we'd say you have to do it by yourself. Why trust God? The Bible always combines the two. Have faith in God, but do good works, is what this is saying. So when you get your eyes off the wicked and onto God, it doesn't mean that you cease to do anything, but you do good works as he's directing. That means your thinking, your acting, your programs are going to be guided by the word of God. Trust in the Lord and do good is the teaching. When I talk about faith, and I do it many times and I repeat it because I think there's a great deal of misunderstanding about faith today, I always say that we're justified by faith, but when we're justified by faith, justification isn't the only thing that happens. There's no justification without regeneration. That means that we have a new life, and it's because we have a new life within that we believe in the first place. God gives us a new understanding, and out of the new understanding we respond trusting God. Now, because we have the new life, we're going to behave in a way consistent with that new life. And if we don't behave in a way consistent with that new life, we don't have that new life regardless of what we profess. Nobody is saved by mere profession. Somebody can stand up in a testimony meeting and say all the wonderful things that they believe, but if they don't live that way, it doesn't mean anything at all. Real faith produces action. The way it has been talked about in theology is by the Latin words notitia, fiducia, and census. Notitia has to do with content. It's like putting up a notice. It's information. And faith has to do with information, content. You don't believe nothing. You believe certain doctrines, truths about God. And that census is consent to it or agreement with it. Here's the information, but now you look at it and you say, that's right, I agree with that. That's the second stage. That's where it touches you personally. But then there's the third stage, the most important of all, fiducia. We get our word faith. It's related to it from the word, but what it really means is commitment to that which we now understand to be true. And that's what this verse is saying. You know about God because the teaching is there. You've assented to it mentally, but now trust in him because God is a God who can be trusted. That's the first thing. Secondly, David says, delight yourself in the Lord. One of the reasons why non-believers won't come, the chief reason why unbelievers won't come to God is that they don't think God is someone in who they can delight. You know, it's a great step forward in our Christian life when we begin to realize something about the nature of sin. You see, sometimes when we're first saved and we don't understand that God has worked in our lives to actually change us so that we're different people, and that's why we respond, we find the gospel so exciting, we think we just go tell anybody about it, and anybody will believe, of course, because it's such a wonderful message, it's such good news. And we do it, we can't understand why they don't respond. Well, the reason is that they have an unregenerate nature. And you talk about God, but they don't want God. I mean, God is the kind of individual they think of as being repressive. It's laying down all those rules of things you shouldn't do. And if they come to that God, he's going to say, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't have any fun. And no, they don't want that kind of God at all. That's why we have difficulty in witnessing. That's why you have to pray that God will change the heart. You see, if God doesn't regenerate, our message is hopeless, but it's through the message that He regenerates. But you see, when you come to God, you find that it's entirely the other way around. The God to whom we come is a delightful God. Now, it's true, He's not a God to trifle with. He's not a buddy. He is a sovereign, all-wise, awesome, holy God. You don't trifle with a God like that. You don't treat Him lightly. But nevertheless, the better you get to know Him, the more delightful you find Him to be. And one reason why so many Christians don't find God delightful is that they really don't know Him. And the reason they don't know Him is they don't spend any time with Him. And what that really means is they don't study the Bible, because it's in the Bible that you find out what God is like. See, if you spend time studying the Bible, and especially getting the words of the Bible into your head, so you begin to think in those categories rather than in the categories that are being forced in upon us all the time by the world, by the repetition, the dull, mindless repetition we hear on television and in other ways, well, then your mind will become a Christian mind. And you begin to realize what God is like, and you say, isn't this wonderful? Isn't this wonderful that at the most basic thing in all existence, in all reality, in the whole universe, is God, who is a merciful, loving, and gracious God. And you'll find yourself beginning to delight in such a one. Have you ever had that experience? Sometimes you have to live a little while in the Christian life before you begin to understand how delightful God really is. If you haven't had times like that in your study, you should have. Learn to spend time with God and find it to be true. There's a promise attached with this. It says, delight yourself in the Lord, and He'll give you the desires of your heart. What does that mean? Does it mean you delight in God, He'll give you any stupid thing you ask for? It doesn't mean that at all. What will you be desiring if you're delighting in the Lord? What you'll be desiring is the Lord, you see. And what that verse means is that if you delight in God, He'll give you Himself. Isn't that a great promise? He won't withhold Himself. He won't say, now you wait in line, you know, like at the supermarket or waiting for food stamps, and I'll get to you in time. No, no. If you delight in Him, you'll find God going out of His way to give Himself to you, because God delights to share Himself with His people. There's the third thing. Commit your way to the Lord. The idea of commitment is involved in faith, and so we might look at that fifth verse and say, well, that's only repeating what's in verse 3. Well, in one sense it may be, but obviously it's going beyond it. And so we say, well, what is involved here? If faith involves commitment, what is David actually talking about when he says, commit your way to the Lord in verse 5? Here's a case in which it helps to know what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew verb there is actually a verb that suggests the mental idea. It says, roll your way onto the Lord. One of the commentators says that literally means you've got a burden and you just roll it off your shoulders onto God. That's what it's saying. And that's what Peter was saying in his first letter. I think it's chapter 5, verse 7. He says, cast all your care upon Him, for He cares for you. I think that's where Peter got it. You see, he says, you are carrying a lot of burdens in your life, and one of them is that you're bothered by all these things that David is going to be talking about in the psalm. You're all agitated about them. You're all worked up. Well, he says, if you trust the Lord and are delighting in Him, the next step is to learn to put those burdens on the Lord. The Lord can carry them. Burdens don't bow Him down. They don't break His back. Learn to put your burdens on Him and find that He's able to bear them, able to bear them for you. Verse 7 says, be still before the Lord and wait patiently for Him. One of my favorite quotations from classical literature is from Blaise Pascal, a great French writer and thinker, Christian apologist. His works are not preserved in a final form because he didn't live long enough to actually put it together, but they're called the Thoughts, the Pensées. And in one section of Pascal's Pensées, he says, the trouble with the world is that people don't know how to sit in their room and be still. I think that's neat. Everybody's always out causing trouble, is what Pascal is saying. Always aspiring for something they don't have any business aspiring toward. So Pascal says, you need to learn to sit in your room and be still. But with all due respect to Pascal, what David is saying here in the psalm actually goes beyond that. He's saying the secret is not merely to be still, but to be still before the Lord. And that is to be waiting patiently for Him. You see the difference? You've got all the agitation out there in the world, and if you're not thinking as a Christian, you'll say, well, I'm just not going to bother about that. That's just more than I can handle. I'm just going to go inside, I'm going to close the shutters, and I'm going to be still. Well, that's a response that will isolate you from what's going on, but that's not the Christian response. The response is to come before the Lord, wait before Him, cast your burden on Him, and then wait to see what God will do. And because you're also told not only to trust in the Lord but do good, perhaps He's going to do something through you to actually help the situation. You see, it's quite a different thing. But then you go back to the situation with quite a different frame of mind. Before you were out there by yourself, now you've been with the Lord, you see. And so you go in the strength of the Lord and in trusting the Lord to accomplish what He will accomplish. That's what David's saying. And then in the 8th verse, the last thing, refrain from anger and turn from wrath. Don't fret, it only leads to evil. It's easy to be angry, but what he says here is that that's not the way the job gets done. Refrain from anger and trust God. Now, we're going to go on to the next section here. The next section tells us that instead of only looking up to God, we're also to look ahead to see what He will do. And what it says is that if we look ahead, that is, take the long view, we're going to find that evil men are going to be cut off. Wicked will be no more, but the meek will inherit the land. Now, with that framework, let me give an illustration, an example of meekness from the Old Testament, breaking into this, you see. There's a chapter in the book of Numbers, which is dealing with Moses and an incident in Moses' life, in which it says Moses was the meekest, our translation says, most humble man who ever lived. Whereas nobody as meek or as humble as Moses upon the face of the earth. And the reason I turn to that story is that it becomes an illustration of the meekness that's described here in the verses we've been studying. What is the story about? Well, it's this. Moses had left Egypt when he had to flee early in his life, and he had gone to Midian, where he had married a woman named Zipporah, the son of the priest of Midian. She was a Semite, and she fit right in with his family. But by the time of the story described in this chapter of Numbers, the 12th chapter, Zipporah had died, and Moses had married another wife who is described as a Cushite. Now, Cush, you have to understand something about this. Cush was the ancient name for Ethiopia. And what that means is that his wife was black. Now, that was something that bothered his immediate family, his siblings. Aaron didn't like it, and Miriam, especially, his sister, didn't like it. And so it became the occasion of a revolt against Moses. They said things like this. They said, has God only spoken to Moses? Hasn't God also spoken through us? And they were trying to instigate a little revolt there among the people, but the real cause is that they felt that somehow their family had been sullied because Moses had married a black woman. Now, God didn't like it, and God called them to meet with Him before the tent of the meeting. It was pitched outside the camp, and God would come down in the form of a pillar of cloud upon the tent of meeting. Moses would often go out there to meet with God, and he would speak to Him, and he would come back with what God had said. On this occasion, God came down, and He called Miriam and Aaron out to the tent of meeting, and He rebuked them. He said, Moses is my prophet, and there's none like him, and I've established him to be the leader of the people. And then God pronounced a judgment upon Miriam because she was the one who had been behind it. And it says that when the pillar of cloud raised itself up from off the tent of meeting once again, there was Miriam, and she was a leper. Now you see, that substantiates the interpretation of the story because it meant that her skin became white. It's as if God was saying to Miriam, you're proud of your Semite blood, you're brown, sort of, and you don't like black. You think being light is better than being dark. Well, then be lighter. And she became a leper. You see, that's what was going on. It was a horrible judgment. And Aaron was aghast, and Aaron interceded to Moses. He said, Moses, pray for her. And Moses did, and she was cured, but she had to stay outside the camp for 7 days in disgrace, you see, because of what she had done. Now, I asked the question, what was Moses' conduct during that entire story? Here his wife was insulted, his authority was challenged, and he retaliated. He had every right to, I suppose, but he didn't do it. This is why he's called, in the context of that story, the meekest man who ever lived. What did Moses do? He did exactly what David is talking about in the 37th Psalm. He trusted in the Lord, delighted in him, committed his way to the Lord, was still before the Lord, and he refrained from anger. And God intervened in his story and reestablished his authority and brought judgment on those who had stood against him. You see, that is what it is to trust God. It's not to take your hands off and say, I don't care about what's going on. Moses cared a great deal. But it's to trust God to work things out and to work through us as he often does. Well, there's a second section here, and let me just suggest a way in which you can deal with it. I think the easiest way is to go down the page and circle the verses in which the word but occurs. The word but introduces a contrast, and it does four times in these verses from 12 to 20. You find it in verse 13, first word, in verse 15, the first word, the second half of verse 17, the first word, and the first word of verse 20. Now here are the contrasts. What you find from this point on in the psalm is a contrast between the wicked and the righteous. In fact, virtually every verse from this point on mentions either one or the other or both. But later on, the contrast is between the wicked and the righteous, and here the contrasts are of a slightly different order. They explain a little more early on the way of the wicked itself. And here's what they say. Number one, the wicked plot against the righteous, but the Lord laughs at the wicked. Verses 12 and 13. You see, when the wicked are plotting, that seems a very scary thing because the wicked are often powerful. And we look on and we say, oh, what in the world are we going to do? It helps to know that it doesn't trouble the Lord in the slightest. The kind of laughter you have here is not a frivolous laughter, as we will laugh at something that doesn't really matter. It's the kind of laughter you find in Psalm 2, where the kings of the earth take their arms against the Lord's anointed, and it says that God in heaven laughs at them. He scoffs at them to think that mere human beings can stand against the Almighty. What a ridiculous thing. And God laughs because he knows he's going to pronounce judgment. That is what is going on here. The plots of the wicked don't trouble the Lord at all. And I apply it this way. You see, if God can laugh at the wicked, well, it may not be possible for us to laugh at the wicked, but we can at least cease from fretting, which is what the psalm's telling us to do. And we can say, Lord, I leave this in your hands. If you aren't troubled by it, well, then I won't be troubled by it either. And I look to you to act. So that's the first thing. Then secondly, we're told that the wicked draw their weapons against the righteous, the sword and the bow. As the way it's described here, they're out to bring down the poor and needy. Today they do it in different ways. Usually it's by money, finances, power, and such things. Verse 15, but their swords will pierce their own hearts and their bows will be broken. That's an interesting principle, one that works itself out in history, though it takes a little while to see it sometimes. That is, people fall by their own weapons. You take somebody who's crafty and is using that to outdo other people, well, it's quite likely that somebody's going to deceive him in time. Or somebody is oppressing somebody else because he's stronger. Sooner or later, somebody's going to come along who's stronger than he is, and he's going to experience the same thing. Herbert Butterfield, an English historian, wrote a whole book on history called Christianity and History After World War II that established that as a principle. What he said is that if you look at history in the long view, you find that those who are evil eventually fall. So he was referring to Hitler primarily with all the might of empire that Hitler was trying to build, but you see, the seeds of destruction were within the wicked empire itself, and eventually it collapsed. And so it is in history. You can see that. We've seen it very much in recent times in the collapse of communism. For all the power, all the might that existed in the communist states, it was a corrupt system, and so in time it collapsed. It collapsed from within, and the very arms that were used to oppress others were used to bring down those who were the oppressors. We've seen it. It's true. Does take time to see it, because in the case of communism, it was a 70-year span. You had two generations of oppression. Many people suffered, many people died, but you see, in the end, the wicked fell by their own arms. It's what these verses say. Here's the next one. The wicked will lose their wealth, but God will sustain the righteous, verses 16 and 17. The wicked certainly can accumulate money, and they seem to be those who are thriving. Everything seems great for them, but they lose it. The fortunes are lost. And in the meantime, God sustains the righteous. A little later on here, David's going to say, I was young and now I'm old, and yet I've never seen the righteous forsaken or their children begging bread. God says he'll take care of those who trust him, not always in spectacular ways and not always in ways that match the affluence of the mighty, but he's going to see that they are preserved during the course of their lives. And then there's the last contrast, verses 18 through 20. The righteous are going to survive, but the wicked are going to perish. Verse 20, the wicked will perish. The Lord's enemies will be like the beauty of the fields. They will vanish. They will vanish like smoke. I like that verse from the way it talks about the smoke, but also because it uses that word beauty. We have a phrase in our day. We talk about the beautiful people. I'm told by those of my friends in California who occasionally rub shoulders with the beautiful people that the beautiful people really are beautiful. On a rare occasion, I have been with somebody who's in the entertainment industry, and it is true, they are not like us. They are perfect. Their teeth are perfect. Their bone structure is perfect. Their hair is immaculate, even if it's not their own hair. And they really are beautiful people. But you see, what this verse tells us is that we're not to envy such people because that beauty is like the beauty of the fields. What does he mean? Well, he means you've got these beautiful flowers out in the field, but how long do they last? They last an afternoon, and then the sun comes up and they wither away. That's the way it is. Lots of people are living with their eyes on Hollywood because ours is a Hollywood culture, and they think, oh, if I could only be like that, one of the beautiful people. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Be like the beautiful people. Well, listen, the beauty of this world fades in a night, but the beauty of the Lord lasts forever. And the beauty of the Lord is the beauty of character, which only Jesus Christ is able to develop within. You see, you can be as beautiful as possible, as handsome as possible, as successful as possible, and all of that will pass. But if the character of Jesus Christ is being formed in you, that's going to last not only for this life, it's going to last forever. So set your eyes on those things. That's what the psalm is saying. Get your eyes off the wicked. Don't envy those who seem to prosper because you evaluate things the way the world evaluates them. Get your eyes on God and begin to evaluate things the way God evaluates them, because that's the eternal thing. That's the real thing. And aspire to be like that. Because if you trust God and delight in him and commit your way to him and are still before him and all the other things, that's what he'll do with you. And as you continue in the Christian way, you will see in time that the spoil of the wicked will be taken away, and the beauty will fade, and the evil will be judged. Some years ago, I heard a story of a farmer out in the Midwest who was no believer and who did what you weren't allowed to do in those days in that sort of Christian culture. He used to work on Sunday, and his fields were right across from a church. And the people of God would be there worshiping in the church, and he'd be out plowing his field during the service. So they'd be singing hymns, and the tractor would be going up and down the fields, back and forth, like this. And at the end of the summer, when the harvest came in, he had a good harvest, and nothing had gone wrong with his fields, and so he wrote a letter to the newspaper pointing out that he had worked on Sunday all through the summer, and he had prospered, and saying, where is the God of the Bible? And the editor of the newspaper was a Christian, and he added a little note to the letter, and the note said this, God does not settle his accounts in October. Now that's what David is saying, you see. He says, take the long view, learn to wait, keep your eyes on God, and you will see. And although things are often bad here, and they are, and for a time, things can be quite grim, in the end, God sustains the righteous, and thank God that it's so. It'd be awful if it was different, wouldn't it? There would be no justice in the universe. It would be folly to try to do any good. We would say the only thing that is worth doing in a world like that is get all you can. Of course, that's the way the world acts. But you see, if God's in control, then it's worth waiting upon God, because he will surely move in his time. Let's pray. Our Father, we find ourselves worrying We worry about all kinds of things, probably more about ourselves than about wickedness, but we don't have our eyes upon you. And what we need to learn is not to worry, but not to worry in the right way. And here's a psalm that teaches us about that. We would ask that you would not only teach us, but enable us to learn, so there might be different men and women because of what you've taught, for Jesus' sake.
Thank you for listening to this message from the Bible Study Hour, a listener-supported ministry of the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. The Alliance is a coalition of pastors, scholars, and churchmen who hold to the historic creeds and confessions of the Reformed faith and who proclaim biblical doctrine in order to foster a Reformed awakening in today's church. To learn more about the Alliance, visit alliancenet.org. And while you're there, visit our online store, Reformed Resources, where you can find messages and books from Dr. Boyce and other outstanding teachers and theologians. Or ask for a free Reformed Resources catalog by calling 1-800-488-1888. Please take the time to write to us and share how the Bible Study Hour has impacted you. We'd love to hear from you and pray for you. Our address is 600 Eden Road, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 17601. Please consider giving financially to help keep the Bible Study Hour impacting people for decades to come. You can do so at our website, alliancenet.org, over the phone at 1-800-488-1888, or send a check to 600 Eden Road, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 17601. For Canadian gifts, mail those to 237 Rouge Hills Drive, Scarborough, Ontario, M1C2Y9. Thanks for your continued prayer and support, and for listening to the Bible Study Hour, preparing you to think and act biblically.